Hello, everybody. I have a very brief presentation, and then I'm going to turn it over entirely to Gary. So on the international stage, Canadians boast that the Indigenous broadcasting system in Canada is the most advanced Indigenous communication system in the world. Yet this is no state-led feat. It is the result of Indigenous activists' efforts to infuse social, broadcast, and other policy both with the principles and of collective self-governance, and as well as Indigenous entrepreneurialism. Self-governance implies the power to frame, finance, implement local, regional, and national agendas and priorities without the state's appropriation and control of the parameters of that evolution. Canadian broadcasting systems, imagined broadly, have circulated more than two centuries worth of images of and stories about, in quotation marks, the Indian. Not to be confused with information about actual Indigenous peoples or realities per se. This repertory or archive of knowledge making is better understood as an intense form of surveillance over the population, one that is governed through the acquisition of particular types of knowledge about its constituent members. And it represents a form of symbolic violence that is tremendously difficult to detect and to disrupt, insofar as it creates obstacles that, while virtual, have become deeply sedimented in the public psyche and the body politic. Once embodied, these symbolic systems are especially difficult to overcome and organize against. The infrastructure that supports this archive of Indianness in Canada, and which structures the architecture of circulation for this knowledge, has been informed by meta-narratives of development, of modernization, of progress, and of evolution. And it is within this vast assemblage of discursive networks that radio and communications technologies more generally take their place as points of relay between bodies and forms of power. Despite all odds, Indigenous activists' continued efforts to achieve support for media access, control over programming and distribution, and more culturally appropriate portrayals of and employment practices have resulted in new configurations of democratic power. Pushing participatory democracy, media activists have called for compensatory histories and anthropologies to move them from their positioning as props and as parts of the scenery toward active political, social, and cultural agents. They've also opened media spaces and administrative debates about cross-cultural development processes in Canada and beyond. Indigenous broadcasting initiatives in Canada have historically demanded not just better representation in mainstream broadcasting, but the transfer of power and control over broadcasting to their own communities, and thus full national media citizenship. The Aboriginal People's Television Network is probably the most widely known Indigenous broadcast facility in Canada. It, like the Alberta Multimedia Society in Alberta, AMSA, Missinippi Broadcasting Corporation in Saskatchewan, Native Communications Incorporated here in Manitoba, NCI, and Wawate in Ontario, to name merely a few, are the products of long traditions of hardcore communications activism that has its roots in the 19th century. While these organizations are noteworthy for their successful capacities to adapt to increasingly austere financial constraints, as well as a host of other difficult circumstances, there are other initiatives whose insolvency speaks as powerfully to the indomitable spirit of Indigenous radio resiliency in Canada. Aboriginal Voices Radio, AVR, is a case in point. While in operation, AVR was Canada's largest native Type B radio broadcaster with a total of five licenses, each in a major Canadian city. It was first licensed in June 2000 to serve Toronto and began broadcasting in 2002. AVR Calgary and Ottawa took to air in 2006, and AVR Edmonton and Vancouver in 2007. The CRTC renewed the licenses in 2006 and in 2010, and then offered short-term renewals from 2012 onward until the license was officially revoked in 2015. When Gary Farmer led a group of media activists that included, among others, our friend Minnie Two Shoes and Andre Morisseau, former bingo caller Chagoosh, Christopher Spence, among many others, and eventually won AVR's first license, it was under the auspices of the CRTC's 1991 Native Broadcasting Policy. This proved problematic for the reason that the policy was woefully outdated, even at that time, and non-responsive to the seismic shifts that were occurring in the telecommunications and broadcasting terrain. Indigenous broadcasting is still regulated by the suite of policies that were created prior to the implementation of most urban and all national Indigenous broadcasting efforts, before digital content production and distribution became the norm, and therefore before any meaningful understanding of what implications the shift from analog to digital technologies might have for the Indigenous broadcasting sector. Additionally, Indigenous broadcasting policy was crafted before the courts had effectively reinterpreted the role of Indigenous people in Canadian society through such landmark cases as Gladstone in 1996, Dalgamuk in 97, Marshall in 99, and Daniels more recently, before the TRC calls to action were issued, and before Parliament had substantially rewritten its laws governing nonprofit organizations. The latter point has enormous implications for the financial well-being of the Indigenous broadcasting sector, since the CRTC's 1990s policy makes it mandatory for all Indigenous broadcasters to operate as nonprofit organizations. AVR was not able to remain afloat in this broadcast, and its license, as I said, was officially revoked in 2015. Last year, APTN established First Peoples Radio. It's a new Indigenous radio service initiative, and APTN has submitted an application to the CRTC to bring a new local Aboriginal radio service to the same urban communities that AVR has evacuated, namely Ottawa, Toronto, Calgary, Edmonton, and Vancouver. AMHSA and Wawate have also submitted competitive bids for several of these licenses, as have others, which speaks to some extent to the competing interests between local, regional, and national efforts, and to the complexities that inhere in creating any sort of representative national Native media organization. Each of these initiatives builds on the work carried out by the founder of AVR, Gary, as well as the newspapers and magazines which preceded it. Each of these pursuits has its place in the social movement that seeks to decolonize the media bureaucracy and to indigenize the broadcasting landscape, to reconfigure power relationships in Canada, and to engage in critical cultural mediation by infusing Indigenousness into the common communication circuitry in Canada. But it's to a more nuanced history of Indigenous radio that we now turn, and it is my great pleasure to introduce acclaimed Cayuga stage and film actor and media activist extraordinaire, Gary Farmer. Gary, who now resides in Santa Fe, is the founder and leader of the band of the Santa Fe, New Mexico-based Gary Farmer and the Troublemakers, an aptly named band, if ever there was one. He recently completed his fifth recorded CD, Road Songs. Gary was the founder and publisher of The Runner magazine, the visionary behind Buffalo Tracks and Aboriginal Voices Radio, and he is a contemporary champion of Indigenous community radio across North America. He is still actively encouraging Native communities to pursue low-power FM radio and believes one day we can connect all communities and together topple capitalism. Yeah. Yay! Most recently, Gary can be seen in The Red Road, which is on Netflix, and a series for Sundance Television, on episodes of a variety of TV series, and on Graves with Nick Nolte. He is returning for the last season on Longmire for one episode. Gary has been enjoying his recent return the stage with Drew Hayden Taylor's Crees in the Caribbean, at Magnus Theatre in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and has an upcoming engagement with Blue Bridge Theatre in Victoria, BC, and Thornton Wilder's classic Our Town. This summer, he is returning to a new musical being developed by Hamilton producers New York Film and Stage of Indian Joe, a story based on True Events by Elizabeth A. Davis. He's playing the title character, who was homeless for 60 years. Finally, he will also be appearing soon on 3 episodes of Derek Miller's Guilt Free Zone on APTN.
Thank you so much. Scanos Wagwego Negaso Hayan Twas. Wanishriya Watni, Nawagos, quite easy. Yeah, I'm originally from the Six Nations Reserve in Southern Ontario. I think a lot of, when I think back, my influences, of course, were my grandmother, who told me never trust the Canadian government when I was just a child. And I that's rings in my head still today. And, you know, I grew some success, I suppose, as an actor right from the get-go. I was trained, exposed to the theater by a Cree man named James Buller, who started this organization that still exists called the Association for Native Development in the Performing and Visual Arts. And from there, once I discovered the power of theater, the power of storytelling, I never returned. I never turned my head back. I realized at a young, tender university age that the society was very corrupt in its operation of social efforts like policing and parole and incarceration, and I knew there was no way I could change that, and that furthered my move to be an artist, someone who could express themselves freely, and that's the only thing that's kept me kind of on the planet somewhat sane, is that power of my ability as an actor. I honed that skill first. That's how I gained any kind of economic and political power, I suppose, at some level. You know, was once I had worked in the high end of the entertainment industry quite young in my tenure, and I've been acting for 43 years, I realized that, especially in Canada, I concentrated on Canada to start. I saw that that they were stealing our stuff, all of our stuff, our stories, our songs, our relationships, our, you know, our ceremonial life, anything they could grab, they would take, and Canadians would make content of it. Spirit Bay, classic case in point. I think they did 13 episodes in the early 80s. And that actual participating in Spirit Bay really founded some of my interest to take our stuff back, you know, to take ownership. Because the other thing was that they weren't training our people outside of Drew Taylor, whose grandmother was one of the players in the piece. I remember Drew was such a clumsy idiot on the set. And they put him in the office, and lo and behold, he became one of our, you know, most prolific playwrights, just because he was working on the scripts and he had no value in a production unit. But that just goes to show you, you know, that, you know, we're kind of ahead of our time there. And I saw that, so that's what got me publishing. I really started the magazine to try and bring all that stuff back, you know. Encourage our writers to write, encourage our photographers to give me the best images, encourage our native graphic artists. At the time, it was a far different industry than it is now, but I really wanted to take that back, and I had to fight to put it in color, you know. I didn't want anything to do with the government. They came to me to train younger native people, and in the end, that's what took me down. So anytime in any broadcast efforts, anytime I got involved with the government, and especially with broadcast entities dealing with the CRTC, the first thing you have to do is incorporate. And you know, and once you incorporate in provincial or federal jurisdictions, then you have to operate a certain way. And of course, the government knows how that works, and they can place people, spy-like types, in your situation to make sure that it's undermined as best they can. That's in their nature. That's how they work. They're treacherous people. And looking back, why I could no longer stay there is because I was infiltrated, I believe, and they paid people to take it down. They paid people to take Aboriginal Voices down, and people accepted the money, and gratefully. The beautiful thing, there's a couple things that we did accomplish, and I know we don't have a lot of time, but one of the most important things, and we were talking last night, that I probably a lot of broadcasters don't realize, but we did incorporate, there's 4% of every broadcaster's budget, and I'm not sure about television, but I'm pretty sure it is, 4% of every broadcaster's budget has to be used for public good. So we got that Aboriginal broadcasting be considered public good. A long time it was Stompin' Tom commercials or put billboards up for Stompin' Tom to make his career a little better. So when we got Aboriginal broadcasting to be, you know, to get part of that 4%, and any broadcaster's budget over the course of a year is significant. So a 1 or 2% or 1.5% of that budget is significant to operate currently broadcasting operations, whether it be the ones that are established or, of course, the best time to get this is when they're renewing their license. All broadcasters in this country have to renew their license, whether public or private, every 6 or 7 years, depending on the situation they're laying, if they're running in accordance with what they're supposed to do or what they promised, you know, their promise of performance. So all in all, it led me to be really quite versed at the time in the late 90s and into the 2000s on broadcast arrangements. You know, something as simple as the actor deal for actors to tell stories on the radio, like the theater. They used to do a lot of theater in the old days for CBC Radio. I suspect that that thing is still in place. So you can actually employ actors for probably nothing. You know, like professional actors to do stories, theater on the radio. So I always wanted to exploit that because that's what I thought. CBC used to do that, but they backed away. The other thing I think we established is the fact that the CRTC and its wisdom was strong enough to at least uphold. We actually did have 9 licenses. We won 9 licenses over the course of which covered at the time, 70% of the Canadian population. That was the idea. My idea was if, you know, CBC could have done this at the amalgamation of their operations in the 40s, but they chose not to, just like they chose not to include women in the Constitution of the United States or in kind of federation of, they could have. They knew that the Six Nations people were running with a strong internal input in terms of who was in power, you know, for life. You know, it's hard to make decisions when you're gonna. You have people you have to elect, and it changes their interests. They're all corporatized, and they've all been bought out for a long time. You know, I wish politicians would be like NASCAR drivers and have the stickers of who they represent, and that goes for tribal officials as well. That's why radio policy or radio broadcasting in this country isn't kind of hard-edged, you know, journalistic. You know, going after the, like a situation like Grassy Narrows. I was there when Ontario Hydro did all the damage in the late 70s. And 2017, they're finally saying, oh my God, we got to do something about this. Like Grassy Narrows has been a story for 40 some odd years that's been like that for these people. And, you know, so things like that just blow my mind. You know, I just spent some time in Thunder Bay and I don't know why these stories aren't told, but, you know, Abitibi merged with whoever to make Resolute. They've been polluting the water in the north. Every 40 miles is a pulp and paper mill. And 73% higher incidence of cancer among Native women in Northern Ontario than anywhere the rest of Ontario. So if any radio operation for Native people is not running by natural law, then what is it running by, right? I mean, you have to, that's your editorial policy. Natural law, the law of the land, is how all broadcasting operations, all Native journalists should be working from. Like, we're out to save the earth now. It's just a war, but they continue to take away our ability to do that, and they'll fight us tooth and nail, and, you know, I can see all of our nations are being co-opted. You know, I got to tell you, and, you know, I'm trying to be with love, but I'll never forget the, God bless him, Bert Crowfoot coming to one of my hearings and having a one stick and breaking it and having a group of sticks and trying to break it and saying it's not going to work. And that's, AVR is the one stick. And where are they all the other sticks? Well, I predated that because I saw my community in trouble. I lived below the Homelon Line. And if you don't know the existence of the Homelon Line in the 70s by the Secretary of State, they cut the country in half, north from south, and said, okay, we're gonna institute television and radio to these northern communities so they can maintain their culture, ways, and language. And all the ones in the south, all the tribes, and that's all half of us, 300 tribes are going to amalgamate in Canadian society. Well, we didn't amalgamate, and 1990 was a perfect case in point in terms of the Oka conflict. But really, the only reason they gave the North, and though they'll say today that they gave it to preserve the language and the culture, and thankfully that the language and culture is a little stronger there than it is in the South, but the real reason, they replaced the church with television, right? So they can consumerize a society within 7 weeks, and I witnessed it as a actor touring the North with a production company out of our theater company out of Toronto called NDWT Theater Company, and we toured Northern Stories through to the people in the far north, Big Trout Lake, all the way across. We rehearsed in Fort Albany. And I saw the impact of television because it started around that period of time, and within 6 weeks, the kids were walking around like Fonzie and trying to get the Sioux Lookout to buy McDonald's hamburgers, right? So they consumerized it, and then they used geologists, the prettiest ones they can find, to go up there and negotiate. Once you consumerize a society, then you can exploit all their mineral wealth, their tree wealth, their water wealth, and that's where we're at right now. They're trying to pollute the water enough so that we have to buy water from them. They're trying to pollute our food so we have to buy food from certain people. And thankfully, the best thing that's happened for now is that Trump got elected and Mexico shut the border. Because now there's hope for the Mexican people to actually begin growing their own food again and not having GMO food fed to them like we are at the rate that we are. So if the Native broadcasters aren't doing this work, acting like the ombudsman for not only our own people, but for all human people, because I always argued that you're all going to learn what it's like to be an Indian in this country. And you can see it before your very eyes within my lifetime. I've seen it. You all know what it's like to feel, be like an Indian, not be protected from pollution, don't have a secure sense of food, especially in the north. And it drives me crazy that some of the politicians, the northern politicians, why aren't they growing, learning to teach the people how to grow food in northern climates? I mean, there's so much technology now with aquaponics and other hydroponics, taking the water from fish and learning to grow green food and Big Trout Lake so that they got good food for health. You know, we wonder why there's suicide at a tremendous rate, because they have absolutely nothing to encourage their way of life. If, you know, Lake Nipigon is one of the most treasured bodies of water in Canada right now because it doesn't have a pulp and paper mill on it, you know, and yet if you ask the community, what's the generating station I see 15 miles below your community? 90% of the people don't even know that there's, you know, a generating, you know, water-based hydroelectric dam that generates the electricity. Like, they're totally uninformed. So how are they supposed to make a decision whether a pipeline should come to their land? Unless we get the information to them that empowers them to make these kind of decisions for their own existence and the welfare of their own people, we're going to continue to see hundreds of young people kill themselves because They don't have no option. Life is better on the other side. We know that there's a spiritual being, you know, whether I got to take myself there or not. And the problem is all the issues that we're facing before it gets to that point. So it's native media's responsibility to attack these questions with fierce ferocity. And I'm really proud that this, at least the CRTC has enough wisdom to preserve the major ones. Because we had 70% of the population. A lot of it did come from Ottawa, which is, of course, the political thing, giant of Canadian politics. And Toronto, of course, is the business, as well as Vancouver. And Calgary, of course, now is the head of the industry for oil, you know, encroachment. So these are the places you need to be. So whoever wins those licenses, please make them responsible to the people for their existence and their lives. Don't let them go in there with interests that are based because they're bankers or because they've exploited. They know how to exploit mining to create wealth for Native communities when we're not looking at the long-term conditions of their existence in terms of our own public health. And money has overturned smart thinking and smart broadcasting and inquisitive broadcasting and the love. We need to share the love more than ever. So, you know, I encourage you to support Native broadcasting, but at the same time, I need you to pressure them to be for real, like for real. No holds bar. What's holding you back? It's not your ads. If it's ads, the best thing for, and I, because I had experience with the CRTC, I'm the one who presented the Aboriginal People's Television Network audiences. And, you know, I'm the one that won the license, really. And all the board of the Television Northern Canada disappeared. They weren't there outside of Alanisa Bombsenwin, but she wasn't even on their board at the time. Now, these people I knew from the 70s, I went to them because they had Secretary of State gave them all the money. I'm a southern community. I went to them and says, look, we gave a tract of land to Anishinaabes right next to us, the, you know, the new credit of the Mississaugas. When they got kicked out of Mississauga, we sold them some land. Their language is in trouble too, and all six of our languages are in our trouble. I know none of you are Cayuga or Mohawk speakers, but, you know, can you help the Anishinaabe by bringing some content down here? And we'll start a radio station that reflects them. And you see, because it was all money and the Secretary of State and they were getting funded and we weren't, they closed the door on me. They shut the door on me. They wouldn't even let me speak to them as a whole. And I always like, geez, I worked hard for you guys, man. I went and won you a TV license. And then the minute I got the TV license, we presented a plan for them to unify the radio, Aboriginal Voices Radio, my magazine, to be the TV guide with APTN, and we'll do the website for you to kind of get the stuff out. We had a 2-year plan to invade the States because we know you can't make TV for 30 million people. You need 300 million people. Then you can make television and people can get paid. Now you've made it work. But 86% of that money came from the Courage. You know, you didn't even need to buy advertising to start the network. But they turned it down. And many of the reasons they turned it down was they thought I was too aggressive in my efforts to kind of, what, you know, make it better for everybody. I didn't make Aboriginal Voices to protect me like all of them did. They all made their situation so you could never get rid of the people that kind of made it happen. They were in there for life. And I'll never forget, I turned to my dear friend, John Trudell, who's now gone, and I said, John, I'm trying to create this national radio system, and I said, I'm not sure how to build the structure so that, you know, I can carry out the vision. And I'll never forget his words. He said, you know, protect it from yourself, you know. So I did. I didn't make it so I was going to be held there and that I wasn't going to run it. And I knew that when the government, because we made a plan so that they could invest $55 million to make this a national radio system. That's what we lacked, was $55 million. And that's not a lot of money. That's what they spent on the RCAP report, 55. I gave Canada a solution to give back our languages, let us interconnect the rural with the urban, which I thought was intrinsic in the world was the culture, the language, the ceremonial life. In the urban, we know about AIDS, we know about alcoholism, we know about carrying, you know, physical abuse. Like, well, there's both. So we had issues to share. We both had health issues. We're all facing 50% incidence of diabetes. CBC doesn't want to deal with that. Only we can deal with that as broadcasters. And so I thought we can entertain. We made AVR 25% spoken word because we wanted to socialize Canadians to who we were, let them know we're not the enemy. We wanted to pull music from Indigenous people around the world. And I had marketeers from this board that would say, anytime you put powwow music on, we lose our audience. So they insisted I take powwow music off. But because I'm the one who developed the whole company, they would never let me do. And I knew that if we make a broadcaster, we have to get the public support. We have to be good enough that the public listens. We can't buy our way into the public's psyche. They have to want us. And when they want us, we do not need any government to fund us. Because we got the power of the people. We've got an audience that we can feed, and they will support us. Just like Amy Goodman. You know, it's no different. And that's how it's got to happen. And it ain't going to happen with government support, because every finance minister that's ever existed in the last 40 years is about exploitation. That's how they became finance kings, because they know how to make money. But going down and cutting down 98% of the forest in Ontario is not smart. That's not who the leader should be. That's not who the finance ministers should be, but that's who they are. And those are the people that we have to dapple around to get what we want. You know, excuse my language, but that's bullshit, right? That's bullshit. So it's up for you all to stand up, Native broadcasters. Man, you got to stand up like you never have before. Because, you know, look at that water protectors in North Dakota. If it wasn't for the Young Turks, I mean, APTN's not there. You know, I don't know, is anyone here from APTN today? Good, good. I'm glad you're here at least, you know. But it's, you know, when we fought in Caledonia, which sent me away from this country, I never saw such disrespect from the media, the police. I don't know where they got these people to raise up against us, but I was so proud of my people then, to stand together silently, protecting what little land we have left after being granted so much land, you know. And it was a proud moment for me. But to see Canada's reaction to our effort, you know, even if we got to cut down a hydro line or two just to help make the point, you know, at least we didn't, with not one gun, not one gun. And to see, and I've been to Standing Rock a few times, and I'm a big time supporter mostly. I carry on the magazine through my Facebook pages. You're all welcome to join me. I got 15,000 plus friends there that I still feed the 15,000 people that I did with the magazine and carry on the work that needs carrying on. I just taken I'm older now. I'm still acting my ass off to survive and tell stories. And I really want to thank you for hearing me out a bit. If you have any questions, while I'm here today, I'd be happy to sit with you and take it any deeper.